Hello, and welcome to our program, Smithsonian, brought to you by Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Margie Lohoff, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Smithsonian Magazine here on Owl Radio. And as I like to remind everyone, the kinds of articles this magazine provides covers a broad range of types of topics, everything from food origins or ecology to geography, pop culture, you name it, which is much like the whole system of Smithsonian museums that exist in the country today. From the article, the first article is from the Smithsonian January-February 2024 issue, and it is the one title, the category in this is Tracing a Lost Ancestry. So it's a bit of an anthropological take. And it is Origin. The subtitle says, in Charleston, South Carolina, members of the local black community are teaming up with scientists to produce a novel study of the transatlantic slave trade. This was written by Maddie Bender and Teddy Brokaw. While digging a trench for the renovation of a local performing arts center in 2013, construction workers in Charleston, South Carolina made a startling discovery: human bones. The crew called the police and coroner's office, unaware they had stumbled upon a late 18th century burial ground. The site's location, along with the coins, ceramics, and beads that had been buried with the bodies, suggested that the people had been enslaved Africans. For years after the initial discovery, scientists and community leaders worked to identify the people who occupied the graves. The city enlisted Ade Ofun-Iyan, known as Dr. O, to help these efforts. A cultural anthropologist, nonprofit director, and grandson of a famed Charleston blacksmith, Ofun-Iyan ensured that the 36 individuals who would come to be known as the ancestors had a modern-day champion. He sought to learn the ancestors' histories and honor their identities. He successfully lobbied the city to reinter the ancestors, and in response to a high school student's question, did the ancestors have names, Ofun-Iyan presided over a traditional Yoruba naming ceremony in 2019. After Ofun-Iyan died unexpectedly in 2020, a group called the Anson Street African Burial Ground Project took up the mantle. He put together a beautiful team of people, says Lashaya Obrey, the group's community education lead, and he left us to continue the work. That work included seeking permission from Charleston's African American community to extract DNA samples from the remains of the ancestors. With the community's consent, the samples were analyzed, and the results shed some light on where the ancestors had originated. Many hailed from West Central Africa, West Africa, or Sub-Saharan Africa. One ancestor was found to have mixed West African and Native American heritage. DNA can only tell you so much. I was just getting so sick of the interpretation being, we have an African individual, and our interpretation is this person is from Sub-Saharan Africa, says Vicky Olzi, an anthropologist at the University of California, Santa Cruz, who studies the archaeology of the transatlantic slave trade. Being able to pinpoint where exactly a person is from, she says, has implications for their culture, their language, their beliefs, their practices, which contributed to so much of the culture of the Americas and the African diaspora at large. To trace those origins with more precision, Olze used a tool called isotope mapping. Just as geographic regions vary in types of rocks and trees, they also have different proportions of elements. Olze and her team focused on the isotopes strontium 86 and 87, which show up in the ancient bedrock of Angola. A quick refresher from chemistry class, isotopes are variations of an element that have the same number of protons. In the case of strontium, that's 38, but different numbers of neurons. The researchers created a map, or isoscape, of Angola, showing where different concentrations of the strontium isotopes are found in the earth. Instead of sampling rocks, Olze and her team analyzed the strontium in modern plants to get a sense of how the isotopes show up in living things. People growing up in Angola in the 18th century would have absorbed the area's strontium isotopes in their bodies. The researchers looked at strontium isotope concentrations in teeth recovered from the Charleston burial ground, as well as other African burial grounds in Rio de Janeiro, Campeche, Mexico, and Philipsburg, St. Martin. In a study published in June 2023, they reported that a handful of candidates from each site could have spent their formative years in Angola. And the researchers pinpointed the specific regions where they would have likely originated. Olze's ambitions didn't stop there. Her goal is to create maps using a variety of isotopes. For instance, levels of oxygen isotopes can tell scientists whether a person lived in a warm, dry region or a moist, tropical one. Sulfur isotopes can indicate a person's proximity to the ocean. Isotopes of carbon and nitrogen, meanwhile, differ according to diet and can be particularly helpful in West Central Africa, where different cultures ate different staple crops. Future isoscapes will reveal increasingly specific details of an enslaved person's early life. Over time, these findings will help form a more complete picture of the entire transatlantic slave trade. Historians have long debated how deeply the trade penetrated into the interior of the continent. Soon, researchers will be able to pair isotope data with other information, like shipping records, to trace a person's likely path from the African interior to an Atlantic port, and then to destinations throughout the Americas. All of that will add up to a remarkably precise and personal view of who enslaved individuals really were. Meanwhile, the Anson Street African Burial Ground Project continues to work toward Ofuniyin's vision. At the site where the ancestors were reinterred, an artist will create bronze casts of the hands of 36 Charleston residents who roughly match the ancestors' heritage, sexes, and ages at death. The hands will sit atop a fountain whose basin incorporates soil from other nearby African-American burial grounds. Those that are forgotten, those that nobody knows about, those that no one can ever find, this monument is going to be a symbol of everybody being in one place, Oubre says. With this data and information that's now accessible, it's like you're dreaming a true dream. Fascinating what we can learn today, isn't it? The next article is in the category of what they're calling Heroes of the Wild, and it is entitled Running Mates. A subtitle is, as giraffe populations plummet across Africa, scientists have designed an ingenious method to study and protect them. And this was written by Alex Fox. They have one of the most instantly recognizable silhouettes on the planet. They walk so gracefully that it looks like they are floating across the savannah, says Michael Brown, an ecologist with the Namibia-based Giraffe Conservation Foundation, or GCF. But our familiarity with these stilt-legged ruminants can sometimes give a false impression of their overall numbers, masking a silent extinction, so-called because it receives little attention compared with the plight of elephant or rhinoceros. In recent decades, however, rapidly expanding agriculture and human communities across Africa have destroyed or fragmented huge swaths of the intact savanna giraffes need to find the trees and bushes they eat, driving a 40% decline of the four giraffe species since 1985. Nubian giraffes, a critically endangered subspecies found in South Sudan, Ethiopia, Uganda, and Kenya, have lost an estimated 95% of their population. Today, they're down to perhaps 3,000 animals. This dire situation recently led GCF to partner with African Parks, a conservation group that works with South Sudan's government to manage neighboring Badinglio and Bama national parks, both Nubian giraffe strongholds, to track, study, and protect the animal. But tracking giraffes presents a famously difficult design challenge. GPS collars typically go around the neck, but giraffe necks, which are 6 feet long, skinny up top, and thin down and thick down below, aren't made for collars. The devices slide down when the animal lowers its head, causing discomfort or risking losing the collar completely. Researchers have tried anklets, chest harnesses, and even tags mounted to the bony, horn-like nubs on top of their heads. But nobody could keep a tracker attached and functioning for long, says Sarah Ferguson, a GCF wildlife veterinarian. In the last 2 years, however, technological advances have shrunk trackers to the size of a candy bar, small enough to strap on to the tip of the tail or an ear. The new tags are solar-powered and less obtrusive, and, with luck, should last a year or more. In April, Ferguson and others from African Parks traversed Badinglio and Boma by helicopter and attached trackers to 11 Nubian giraffes. The data they are collecting will help identify key habitats and favored routes within the park's combined 7.4 million acres of wetlands and savanna, potentially spurring their expansion and showing where extra patrols to limit bushmeat poaching or community education to encourage local buy-in for conservation can save giraffes' lives. We can't conserve what we don't understand, says Julian Fennessy, co-founder and conservation director of GCF. We need these data to protect this landscape before it's too late. And that is Heroes of the Wild, about Nubian giraffes and trying to protect a critically endangered creature. Next, we're going to have quite a variety of topics here. This is from the Ask Smithsonian column that is in each issue. And it's questions that people write in and answers from different experts at the Smithsonian. The first one is from Pam Johnson of Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. I thought I saw more red foliage this fall. Is that related to climate change? And the answer from Jessica Hsu, head technician for Forest GEO, Smithsonian Environmental Research Center, says, when trees stop producing chlorophyll, other compounds shine through. The compounds vary by species and determine the color of the tree's autumn foliage. So a species like the ginkgo, which turns yellow in fall, won't turn red. But climate volatility can produce displays that are more or less vibrant in a given year. Warm days and cool nights tend to produce the best fall color. A 2021 study suggested that northeastern U.S. maple leaves are changing later, though climate change can also bring dry weather, pests, and pathogens, which could make leaves fall sooner. And next, the question is, how accurate are prehistoric instruments that measured the solstice or the planets? That's from Joan J. Matthews of Englewood, Florida. And the answer is from William Fitzhugh, senior scientist at the National Museum of Natural History. Prehistoric people had their own ways of predicting solar and stellar motion. Viking navigators accurately determined latitude by using a notched stick to measure the height of the sun at noon. The stone circle at Stonehenge, erected around 2500 BC, measured angles at the solstice by observing the sun as it appeared in certain aligned openings. The path of the sun was important in many cultures. I researched the Mongolian Bronze Age around 3,000 years ago, where people aligned rows of east-facing megaliths called deer stones in a north-south direction. Sometime between 220 and 150 BC, people in the Hellenistic world invented the astrolabe, a metal disc with carefully placed openings that let them calculate the positions of the stars and planets more precisely. Interesting. Moving on, the next question. Some mammals have tails that seem useless, or am I missing something? Asks Steve Richardson of Knoxville, Tennessee. Melissa T.R. Hawkins, the curator of mammals at the National Museum of Natural History, provided the answer to his question. At first glance, it may seem that many mammals don't use their tails for much, but in fact, they do. Dogs, for example, use their tails for social signaling. You can observe hierarchy by whether a tail is held straight up or pointed downward or between the hind legs. Some cats, such as the cheetah, use their tails as a counterweight to help them balance. Some mammals have prehensile tails and can hang from them. Well, we certainly know about some of those, don't we? The Bornean tufted ground squirrel puffs up its beautiful long furred tail, likely to confuse potential predators. And here in Texas, I have always heard that white-tailed deer use the white tail when they are being stalked because as they are running to escape a predator, it confuses the predator as to where to make the pounce or the leap because the tail is white and moving and the rest of the deer keeps going. I mean, the tail does too, of course, but that the predator can misjudge its direction. And finally, the question, why did American cartoonists switch from using captions to speech bubbles? That Mary C. McCune from Lakeside Park, Kentucky wonders. Modern comic art follows caricature traditions that began as early as the 18th century. Dialogue used to be contained in labels or long, outlined word balloons. The Yellow Kid, generally considered the first U.S. comic strip character, spoke in rounded speech bubbles when he first appeared at the end of the 1800s. The use of speech bubbles continued through the 1910s, when artists began to be hired across the U.S. to produce a variety of cartoon titles, and into the golden age of superhero comics, which started with Superman's 1938 debut, and they prevail to this day. And that answer was from Joan Boudreau, curator of printing and graphic arts at the National Museum of American History. That's a curious little topic, for sure. Not sure I ever wondered about speech bubbles in cartoons. Well, moving on, this is actually going a little bit backwards to the December of 2023 issue of Smithsonian. And each magazine begins with an essay from the Secretary of the Smithsonian, Lonnie G. Bunch III. And there are very interesting topics that he comments upon. And this one is entitled Course Correction. As the Smithsonian grapples with a dark legacy, a new task force will recommend ethical policies for handling human remains. Interesting. For more than a century, anthropologists at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History have obtained, studied, and stored thousands of human remains. While the practice can reveal critical details about past civilizations, it now comes with a host of ethical considerations which have significantly changed the scientific process. Most of the remains still in our possession were acquired decades ago without the proper consent of the individuals, their close relatives, or their tribal communities. The Smithsonian is currently taking steps to rectify these wrongs and prevent any future recurrence. This month, the Smithsonian's new Human Remains Task Force will deliver its recommendations on how we should best proceed with the repatriation of some 30,700 human remains in our collections. Most of those remains were obtained between 1903 and 1941 when Alex Redlicka served as head of the Physical Anthropology Division at what is now the National Museum of Natural History. With the goal of scientifically proving the since-debunked myth of white superiority, Herdlicka was a leading figure in a scientific community that espoused notions of white supremacy, and he took particularly interest in the remains of indigenous people and people of color. Herdlicka and others in his field looted graves and obtained remains without individual consent from morgues and hospitals in more than 80 countries, sometimes with the help of physicians whose patients had died. Today, left to reckon with the aftermath of that dehumanizing practice, we are working toward repatriating remains from Herdlicka's tenure. It's a collection that should never have been amassed, and we're committed to dismantling as much of it as possible in a way that recognizes and honors the people affected. Since the passage of the National Museum of the American Indian Act in 1989, the Smithsonian has repatriated the remains of more than 5,000 people, and we are working to accelerate that pace. There is no legislation that addresses the unethically obtained remains of non-native people, but the Smithsonian's forthcoming policy will steward the return of all remains regardless of cultural affiliation. This challenging task involves using the limited records we have to identify who these people were and who their surviving relatives might be. When it's not possible to identify a direct descendant, we will work with descendant communities. That said, we are committed to standardizing the ethical return and repatriation process as much as possible, while maintaining the flexibility to accommodate the wishes of descendant communities. The recommendations will also outline what types of research on human remains we will allow going forward. This forthcoming policy will be heavily informed by the task force's recommendations, and I trust it will be historic for the Smithsonian and the museum field worldwide. I am determined to position the Smithsonian as a leader, not just in scholarship, but also in the ethical considerations that inform that scholarship. That is a noble and certainly worthy project that the Smithsonian is undertaking. Good luck for them. Well, the next is a little bit lighter-hearted, and it is entitled The Stuff of Legend. And this is The Past is Prologue under American Icon. It was written by Alice George. This is interesting. The true history of the teddy bear begins in the African, listen to me, in the American wilderness. In November 1902, President Theodore Roosevelt embarked on a hunting trip in Mississippi with one main goal, to bag a black bear. As the tale goes, after Roosevelt had scoured the brush for several days without so much as spotting one, some of his hunting companions corralled an injured old bear and tied it to a willow tree. Here, they said, was Roosevelt's opportunity to grab one and declare victory. Horrified, the president refused, saying it would be unseemly, unsporting, for a man of honor to kill this vulnerable creature. He ordered the decrepit bear to be euthanized, and this odd show of mercy quickly became news. Editorial cartoonist Clifford Berryman captured the scene in several Washington Post drawings, one showing a thin Roosevelt refusing to kill a bear, another picturing a more realistically stocky Roosevelt near a smaller bear with a wide-eyed, baby-like face. To Brooklyn candy store owner Morris Meichtum, the cute cub from the cartoons also looked like a marketing opportunity. He asked his wife Rose to sew a stuffed version, and that single prototype sold shortly after the couple placed it in the store window. Rose made more, and with demand exceeding what busy fingers could create, the two began factory production in 1903. Meichtum called his cushy new companions Teddy's Bears, after the president. By late 1903, the name had shifted to Teddy Bear. At about the same time, the Stief Company of Gingen, Germany, was coincidentally creating a bear of its own. In 1903, Stief sold 3,000 of the critters to a New York department store. A year later, Roosevelt, who couldn't abide the nickname Teddy, he had once called it an outrageous impertinence, nevertheless deployed his lovable namesake as a mascot in his re-election campaign, prominently displaying a Meichtum bear at the White House. That helped propel the animal to further fame, and in 1906, one Manhattan store sold more than 60,000, and soon even the German maker Stief adopted the American teddy bear name. Now, who would ever have wondered or thought about the origin? I had read somewhere about it being connected to Teddy Roosevelt, but I did not know why. Interesting and very curious. Well, you have been listening to Smithsonian on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Margie Lohoff saying goodbye from Owl Radio. I know my kids loved their teddy bears. Goodbye.